Hello. On this week's program, we speak with mezzo-soprano Kirsten Chavez. The rising star of opera is applying her considerable vocal and acting talents to widely differing roles. Jason Pfeiffer is at the Prince Music Theatre in Philadelphia to catch up with developments in their latest production, a world premiere readaptation of Cole Porter's The Pirate. Susan Lewis looks at how music theatre has evolved over the years, and we visit an Institute of Contemporary Art exhibit that examines the role of how where art is located affects how it's perceived. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
A trouser role is when a female opera singer plays the part of a man or boy. Now, one rising young mezzo-soprano who, on the face of it, should be unsuitable for such roles is gaining a growing reputation for being one of the boys. Kirsten Chavez is also, ironically, the perfect Carmen. And not surprisingly, this visually stunning, raven-haired young woman does sing a lot of lead roles in that Bizet opera. Yet she also has a particular gift for so-called pants or trouser roles. She's appearing in the Opera Company of Philadelphia's current production of Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro as Carabino, a teenage boy. We met earlier this week during rehearsals. When you play Carmen, I mean, I can see that you can play Carmen and understand the role. I think I'm correct in assuming you've never been a 13-year-old boy.
I haven't, and I must confess it does challenge me a bit to try to imagine, you know, what they would be like physically, what they might be thinking or feeling. So it's not an easy thing to pull off. But, it's not too hammy in the sense that I have a solid tradition behind me, you know. I mean, interestingly, in the world of opera, part of the reason for the convention is because you kind of assume that it's a boy before his voice has dropped and changed, so that the pitch of the voice mm-hmm. is better to be high. And so that's, I think, a large reason why the mezzo-soprano was chosen. But, you know, I know that in the past there have been lots of famous singers singing these roles. Some of them, I felt, didn't make a really big effort to be realistic in the role, because everybody knows they're a girl, and so they just kind of, you know, sing pretty and that's that. But I really like to go there. I really like to try my best to give the impression so that people are watching and they're like, wait a minute. You know, I like to make them stop and think, because physically I make a very concerted effort to give the impression that I am the character that I'm playing, who happens to have a high voice, you know, no big deal.
And tell me about the preparation for it then.
I mean, I've played a number of pants roles over the years. One of my favorites being Octavian in Rosenkavalier. That one's a little bit different because he's older and more involved with the ladies. So that has other challenges. But, you know, I have studied, if you will, how men walk differently from women.
Okay, and how do men walk differently from women?
Well, it's a matter of hips, my dear. It really is. It's a matter of hips. We have these things that move from side to side, and you just kind of are sort of straight. And also, you know, running. I've actually seen myself, like, running on video, like when I did Rosenkavalier, and I'm like, darn, I missed that one. Because the thing is that our arms tend to kind of splay out to the side in back of us when we're running, whereas you guys are just kind of straight back. So I've had to really kind of think about that. Plus, different parts of the body will tend to lead you as you walk. And a woman might lead more with her chest. A man might lead more with other parts of his body, depending, you know. So these are all things that really can make a big difference when you're just kind of watching somebody walk. The subtlety is maybe hard to pick up on, but it's almost like this unspoken language, you know. It's either a mostly masculine walk or a mostly feminine walk, and the hips have a lot to do with it. What part of the body leads you has a lot to do with it. How you hold your hands, how you clench your fists or whatever when you're running, you know, are you a girl or a boy? They're all very distinct, subtle but distinct. And so I pay attention to these things.
And then having put this amount of thought into how you physically construct the character when you're playing a man or a boy, have you then taken that idea and said, well, you know, if I can apply this kind of intellect to a character that's very different from my own experience, do you then apply those same kind of techniques to playing, I don't know, a Carmen, for instance?
Absolutely, Jim. And you know what? This is the thing that I've learned. I have kind of a theatrical background. My mother was a drama coach, my drama coach, God help us all. And, you know, I've learned a great deal about acting early on before I became an opera singer. And the one thing that I discovered was important for me was that it really is all in the details. And it doesn't matter if I'm playing a boy or a woman or whatever. When I play Carmen, and even before I had ever played pants roles, I knew that it was in the detail. You know, it's how would Carmen hold her hands at this moment? How would she, you know, how would she physically stand and carry herself? Because she's a confident woman, because she's strong, because she's happy in Act One, because in Act Four she's not so happy. You know, these are differences that I absolutely pay attention to. And even though an audience member might watch me and think, wow, that I really believe that character, he might not be able to say, I believe that character because she's really very lined up. You know, her whole body is displaying what that character would be. He doesn't know that, but he sees me walking or dancing or singing or just pointing or whatever. And I make a concerted effort to make all of that work together to display my character at every level.
Kirsten Chavez in the role of Carabino in an excerpt from Wednesday's dress rehearsal of the Opera Company of Philadelphia's production of Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro. It's at the Academy of Music in Philadelphia through May 21st.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The Prince Music Theatre's latest work, The Pirate, is a new musical adapted from a film that features the music of legendary composer Cole Porter. The classic Porter movie is also an adaptation. It's based on a 1942 Broadway play. As Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer reports, this twice-revised story celebrates the rich heritage of American film and theater in several different ways.
Writers David Levy and Zach Manna began working together in 2000 to bring a musical version of The Pirate to the stage. But Manna says the creative process began long before their initial collaboration 6 years ago.
This started in 1948 when I saw this movie as a kid, and I fell in love with it immediately.
The movie that Zach Mana saw was MGM Studios' version of The Pirate, which starred Judy Garland and Gene Kelly. It was directed by Vincent Minnelli, who also helmed the films Meet Me in St. Louis and An American in Paris. To complement the singing and dancing of Garland and Kelly, MGM commissioned Cole Porter to write the score of The Pirate. Porter, whose Broadway musical hits include Kiss Me, Kate and Anything Goes, wrote over 1,400 songs throughout his life. Be a Clown, performed here by Gene Kelly in the Pirate film, is just one of his more well-known melodies.
Be a clown, be a clown, all the world loves a clown. Act a fool, play the calf, and you'll always have the last laugh.
Over 50 years after The Pirate was released, the musical comes to the Prince Music Theater stage as part of the theater's American Legacy series. It celebrates the great traditions of American music theater. Pirate director Richard Parison views the new show as a perfect fit for the Prince.
What better to have an exciting movie that starred Judy Garland and Gene Kelly, directed by Vincent Minnelli, have the music of Cole Porter, and do a world premiere, which is what The Prince is all about. So this really wrapped up a lot of items in our mission under one roof.
A Belvedere is boundless as the great ocean blue, forever fierce, forever true, possessing deeds of dash and dare, to the thought of you, my cocoa, cocoa, cocoa.
The Pirate is set in the West Indies and spotlights Manuela, played in that excerpt from Rehearsals at the Prince by Andrea Burns. The young woman falls in love with Serafin, a traveling actor. To win Manuela's heart, Serafin impersonates a notorious pirate known as Makoko. His masquerading, however, only incites the opposition of the town's mayor and eventually draws out the real Makoko. Although the original staging of this tale dates back to the 1940s, Richard Parison says the musical doesn't feel dated.
I think one of the things we're doing with The Pirate that I hope audiences feel compelled to respond to is that we're taking these established tunes that people have heard, and we're giving them a fresh spin for this production. We're making them contemporary. We're making them modern. That's what I think that good music can do. It can survive really great vocal arranging and really great dance arrangements.
There is indeed a lot of singing and dancing in The Pirate. After all, the stars of the movie version, Kelly and Garland, were best known for performing both enchanting movement and melodies. However, David Levy says the new show doesn't stick too closely to the film.
Our attempt is to not recreate an MGM musical, which we can't do because we don't have the time or the resources or the money. But we want to create our own piece, our own particular new stage musical of a show that has never been done on stage before. And I also think it's great that a whole new generation of people become familiar with Cole Porter music.
To be sure, the Pirate stage musical is a celebration of Porter tunes. To adapt the story for the stage, Zach Mana and David Levy use songs from the 1948 film and Cole Porter's larger body of work. But Levy explains that not all of the show numbers come from Porter's repertoire, as they had to write some additional songs.
There were three places in the show where we needed very specific plot, character-driven book songs. And after looking through hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of songs by Cole Porter, we really couldn't find anything that was specific enough to meet our needs. So with the permission of the Cole Porter Trust, we were allowed to add these three songs. And they're serviceable songs. They service the book. We would never in any way attempt to copy or to compete with Cole Porter. Our goal is, I think, if we're successful, that they will meld in sort of seamlessly and not seem like another animal.
A story that involves pirates is not a new animal either. From Pirates of Penzance to Peter Pan to Pirates of the Caribbean, it seems that these swashbuckling heroes and villains have a perennial appeal. Zach Mana agrees.
I think it's the old tale, like a fairy tale, of the lust for gold, the lure of the tropics. It's all of that. And it's been with us for a long time. I've started back in the silent movie days, certainly started before the movies. People love it.
Mana goes on to compare pirate stories to movie westerns, only they're set on the high seas. In the case of The Pirate at the Prince, it's the high seas of the West Indies, and navigating the same waters of the original Broadway play and the subsequent MGM film, the story sets sail yet again this evening.
Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer. Previews for The Pirate begin tonight at the Prince Music Theatre in Philadelphia. The show runs through May 28th. People have been singing songs, moving to music, and telling stories on stage for centuries. The Greeks put music to their comedies and tragedies. The Romans used songs and dance in theatre, and are said to have created the first tap shoes to make steps audible in their open-air theatres. And opera has been staged since the early 1600s. Yet musical theatre in the form we experience today is a relatively recent art form. Now, Creatively Speaking, Susan Lewis takes a look at the history of musical theatre, where it came from, where it is today, and where it's going.
That may sound like opera, which it is. It's Baz Luhrmann's version of La Bohème on Broadway. But is it musical theater? If it has music and theater, and it's on Broadway no less, it must be musical theater, right? Actually, musical theater is kind of hard to define. It's everywhere, from high school stages to regional theaters to Broadway, but its very popularity seems to make it a stepchild of serious art. There are lots of arts programs where you can study music or theater, but not musical theater. So is musical theater just a lowbrow form of opera? Or is it descended more from variety shows and vaudeville? Is musical theater a distinct art form in its own right? Peter Reynolds, an adjunct professor at Temple University, teaches the history of American musical theater and says it is a distinctly American art form.
You could argue that it's America's greatest contribution to theater. It is certainly our unique contribution.
Marjorie Samoff, the founder and producing artistic director of the Prince Music Theater in Philadelphia, agrees and attributes this to the eclectic combination of influences in early 20th century America, including opera and vaudeville.
Pioneers who created the American musical theater in the early part of the 20th century, they were all schooled in, quote, serious music, so they did know opera. They were also imbued with the theatrical world of vaudeville, but they were also listening to the very beginning of jazz, and they certainly had this immigrant ability to import European forms, link them with American popular forms, and make something new out of it.
The new something that emerged was more than a string of songs like those in vaudeville. It was also different from opera, on the most basic level because dialogue was spoken, not sung. But also, says Peter Reynolds, the artistic priorities were different.
The thing of utmost importance in an opera is the music. It's the predominant element. In my opinion, that's the difference. Of course, the story is important in opera, but in a musical, it's the story first.
The first milestone in this effort to bring together different entertainment elements was a production based on a novel by Edna Ferber, with music by Jerome Kern and book and lyrics by Oscar Hammerstein II and P.G. Woodhouse. Showboat opened in 1927 and sowed the seeds for what was to come, the creation of an integrated theatrical form where songs and dance were not merely accessories, but ways to move the story forward. In 1943, Rodgers and Hammerstein's Oklahoma met that challenge and became the standard by which other musicals were measured.
Oh, what a beautiful morning! Oh, what a beautiful day!
Ted Chapin, a longtime director and producer of musical theater, is executive director of the Rodgers and Hammerstein Organization in New York, which represents and licenses more than 100 musicals and revues. He says that Oklahoma was followed by waves of literary musicals, at the heart of which were really good stories that integrated music where it served the drama.
The skill of taking characters and creating a musical, theatrical way to tell a story involving those characters that doesn't seem to make any logical sense and yet makes incredible sense. The King of Siam has no right to sing. It's a dramatic story. It's about schoolrooms. It's about kingdoms. It's about people in love, people not in love. And yet they were able to construct it in such a way that you just bought all the songs as coming from the characters and the situations.
And so Broadway told stories of racism, forbidden love, culture clashes, and the pull of tradition, with musicals like South Pacific and The Sound of Music and Fiddler on the Roof, just to name a few. It could take audiences to London in My Fair Lady and Oliver, to small towns in the Midwest in The Music Man, and to the streets of New York in West Side Story. If a musical was successful, audiences would remember the stories and walk out humming the tunes. And of course, as the big payoff, a blockbuster movie would follow. Over time, musical theater began to change its form, in part due to the changing musical tastes and themes of the times. Ted Chapin says that even more important was the shifting balance of power among the collaborators.
For example, I mean, in the Rodgers and Hammerstein era and the era that followed it, the authors were in charge. But then afterwards, the director-choreographer period came in and much more show business came into the musical theater and less literary stuff.
Music of the 60s and early 70s led to rock musicals like Hair, Tommy, and Jesus Christ Superstar. At the same time, students of traditional musical theater were experimenting with form. In 1970, a young protege of Oscar Hammerstein named Stephen Sondheim wrote a musical called Company, a show about love and marriage, driven less by plot than by the ideas. Company's success ushered in a new era of the concept musical. Although Sondheim's work seemed to reflect a new freedom, Chapin says that Sondheim and other innovators had common roots in traditional theater.
Amusingly, the other person who was wildly influenced by Rodgers and Hammerstein was Andrew Lloyd Webber. He was very aware of the musical side of what Rodgers and Hammerstein was doing, and in some ways, he sort of followed a musical path, whereas Sondheim has followed a more lyrical path.
And so the possibilities for musical theater expanded. The 80s and 90s saw the invasion of the British mega musicals, huge entertainment spectacles like Cats, Phantom of the Opera, and Les Miserables. Ted Chapin questions whether these sung-through performances are really musicals at all.
They are pop operas, they are pop operettas, call them what you will. They are sung through in lieu of being able to figure out how to dramatize a story. They'll tell you what happened while the music is going on, but it's done with such stagecraft that you're just swept away by it.
Today on Broadway, you see stripped-down versions of big-time musicals, as well as some originally crafted productions, even if they come from unlikely sources. The classic musical theater form today lives in a more diverse theatrical neighborhood of shows based on movies, pop songs strung together, and operas written by rock stars. So is musical theater today a form of opera? Is it an assembly of songs? Is it great storytelling set to music? True to its American immigrant roots, musical theater today is all of the above.
Creatively speaking, Susan Lewis.
Everything in life is only for now.
Philadelphia's Institute of Contemporary Art is in a modern building on the campus of the University of Pennsylvania. Just 2 miles but many worlds away is Bartram's Garden, the preserved home and garden of 18th century botanist and plant explorer John Bartram. But what do these two Philadelphia institutions have in common? One with the rustic feel of a gentleman's farm, despite the decaying neighborhood which surrounds it. The other with its straight lines and paintings hung neatly on its white walls, surrounded by the youthful bustle of an Ivy League campus. Well, for the next couple of months, admission to one gains you admission to the other. This is not just an experiment to cross-promote two different spaces. No, both institutions are home to the ICA's current exhibition, Soft Sites. That's site as in S-I-T-E, which explores the role location has in how art is interpreted. The curator of the show, Sara Reisman, has spent much of her career focusing on public art. She says the declining number of places available to install outdoor art is one of the things that got her thinking about this show.
As a result of public space in New York in particular becoming less available and less flexible and less usable and kind of more regulated, artists are unable to really conceive of works that have a longer duration in public spaces. I mean, it really has to do with the corporatization of the public realm.
Which leads to the part of the exhibition in the Project Space Gallery at the ICA. In this space, each piece has been previously shown somewhere else, other museums, parks, and public spaces. What all the pieces have in common are themes of place, sometimes in an abstract way, such as being late or lost, but others are quite literal, such as the neon sign which reads, "You are here." Over at Bartram's Garden, the setup is quite different. not just because of the 18th century barn and the flowers, but because Riesman had a different intention for these artists.
For the artists who I invited to make works there, the parameters were, please do something that responds to the site in the more traditional model of site-specific practice. And I thought it was a nice counterpoint to this, the notion of the flexible place or the flexibility of place. Bartram's doesn't have much flexibility.
Not much flexibility? Wouldn't a natural outdoor space have more flexibility than a boxy art gallery? Riesman admits as she spent more time at Bartram's garden, her mind did change about this. Her initial thinking was based on the fact that it was a 250-year-old preserved historic space. The art here is both inside the 18th century home of Bartram and outside in his preserved garden. Some pieces blend, such as a recreated seed archive or a sculpture entitled Monument to Weeds. Others are in contrast with the space, such as McKendry Key's sculptural formations of bright pink balls dotting the wetlands, very much transforming the site. And in the coming months, as the trees bloom and the flowers grow around the installation, the site will very much transform the work. For small hidden treasures like Bartram's garden, rich in history and beauty but hurt by geography, this sort of partnership is an opportunity to draw new visitors to the site, as Director of Education and Public Programming Melanie Snyder explains.
We're hoping that this type of exhibitions, having exhibitions like this, will really increase more visitors and different types of visitors coming out to the site, and as well as for the community who comes in and enjoys it on a regular basis to have something else to look at.
In addition to bringing new visitors to Bartram's garden, Snyder also sees the installation as a way to expose the neighborhood kids to some new art forms.
Whenever they come, they have their educational lesson, and then we give them a house and garden tour. So when we're doing the garden tour, we'll make sure we talk about the different art installation pieces that are here, and also that art doesn't necessarily mean it's a painting on canvas, that there's different types of art.
And who knows, maybe some of the art museum goers could use a breath of fresh air. Soft Sites runs through July 31st at the ICA at 36 and Sampson Street and at Bartram's Garden at 54th and Lindbergh Boulevard in Philadelphia. And that's it for now. Our program written and produced by Teresa Madden and myself, with thanks also this week to Beverly Volpe, Tracy Gallagher, Bert Fink and Pat Allen. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.